So I've called this talk, The Five Indriyas and Climate Change. So the Indriyas are a teaching in Buddhism, probably mainly in the Theravada tradition. And Indriya basically means faculty or power. So the five Indriyas are the five faculties of the meditation mind that we develop for meditation. And the idea is that as we develop these faculties for meditation, we gain power through them, and that can then help us on the Buddhist path that gives us the power and strength needed on the path. And the idea is that they're like tuning an instrument, so we don't want to be too tight around them, but we also don't want to be too loose. So it's about finding a good balance with the five qualities. And they sort of follow in an order, but of course you also go back and forth and they interact as well and balance each other out. So the five Indriyas are faith, energy or effort, mindfulness, concentration or shamatha, and wisdom. And so what I'd like to do is talk about them first in a sort of meditation context, and then also explore how they might be relevant in terms of facing up to the realities of climate change. So faith is an interesting one. Sometimes it's also described as trust or confidence, and it's basically a sense that my efforts are worthwhile. So what I'm doing here has some value. And in meditation, that can be both external validation that what we're doing is worthwhile, and also from internal. So if you grew up in a Buddhist culture or a Buddhist family, you'd have quite a lot of external validation saying that these are practices that are wholesome and worthwhile, worth pursuing. And in our context, probably most of us didn't grow up in a Buddhist household, but we've had a lot of science on mindfulness. So we've had a lot of studies, thousands of studies saying that meditation is a good practice and it's definitely worth keeping it up. So that can be helpful to have that external sort of, I guess, encouragement and validation. But my experience from teaching a lot of mindfulness and also my involvement in this group over many years has been that I think what really matters is more the internal faith or trust that this is actually something that is worth pursuing, because it takes quite a lot of effort. And it's quite easy to sort of lose track of the practice. So the external helps, but it's really the internal drive that seems to be what keeps people engaged in a long-term meditation practice. And then the second one is effort and energy. And as we all know, meditation takes quite a bit of effort. We are all giving up all of Sunday today and, you know, probably have a daily practice at home and other ways. And people often think, you know, if you say you're going on a meditation retreat, they say, oh, it's lovely, that sounds really relaxing. And you start explaining what's involved and it's like, oh, no, that's far too much hard work. And as we all know, it is a lot of hard work to sit for hour after hour. So there's quite a lot of effort involved, again, to keep it going long term. But the flip side of that is that a meditation practice will also give us more energy. So over time, as our thoughts aren't quite as all over the place, a little bit more settled, as our body relaxes physically, we're not sort of holding as much tension in our body over the years, it actually gives us more energy. And the energy is considered very important in Buddhist practice, that we bring lots of energy into it. So it's not just sort of enduring or putting up, but it's actually coming to the practice with quite a bit of energy. And the meditation can certainly help us feel that we start to get more energy as we progress in meditation. And then mindfulness is also obviously one of the part of the Eightfold Path, a key teaching in Buddhism. And as we know, of course, it's also secular mindfulness has become very popular. And mindfulness, there's actually lots of different ways that different teachers describe it. But one way is just to be present with what is. So that real sense of just turning up and being present to what is, and actually quite simple. But also noticing what's going on. And I think that's where, when we do a lot of meditation, we really start to tune into the more subtle sensations that are happening. So often when we're very busy and running around and got lots of things in our head, we don't actually take notice of things either within us or without us. So we might miss the fact that our body is feeling a certain way. We might miss what's happening for people around us, but we might also miss the fact the sun is shining and there's some birds singing, and that, you know, there's a big noise or, you know, whatever is happening around us. So we sort of missing out on a lot of information. And mindfulness in the meditation practice is really about that, settling everything down so we attune to more the subtle things that are happening within us. And it's really at that subtle level that is really where the meditation practice is transformative. So we may not, you know, be living a life that's really, you know, full of hatred and destructiveness and things. So we may be living a fairly okay life, but when we start to meditate or keep meditating, we notice, oh yeah, there's little bits of, you know, resentment, or there's a little bit of tension here, or aversion, or daydreaming and things like that. So we start to notice more the subtle. So the mindfulness is very key to that. And then the next one after mindfulness is concentration, or shamatha. And I actually found that interesting that it, in this, you know, form, it comes after mindfulness, because we often think of concentration as something practice you do first and then later you get to the mindfulness practice. And certainly when I was doing the Zen meditation, the first few years were very much based concentration, counting the breath and things, and then afterwards it was more the mindfulness practice. And that's how we also teach secular mindfulness, so we do a little bit of steadying and then start to open up to experience. But I've actually found for myself with my own practice that I've gone back more to concentration again. It just sort of feels right after spending a lot of time, many years with mindfulness. And of course it related, you know, we're always doing a bit of both, but in terms of the focus. And yeah, and then I've heard different teachers talk about these five indriyas, and they actually say, you know, the mindfulness helps you be aware of what's going on, but the concentration then really focuses that energy. And so you're not sort of resting it, and it's much more contained. So it's actually quite a powerful thing to do. And then at the end is the wisdom. And in Buddhist terms, that would be things like knowing that everything is impermanent. And not knowing intellectually, but really knowing that, you know, everything is impermanent, and that sense of no self, that sense of interbeing, interconnectedness. Yeah, so through the meditation practice, we have a sense of, perhaps one way would be described, spaciousness. And like the reading we had by John Wellwood, there's not that sort of brittle defense around it, but there's more sense of opening up. So that would be wisdom from a Buddhist point of view. And the idea with these ones is that they balance each other out. So if you, for instance, have too much energy, there's a lot of agitation involved and a lot of sort of nervous energy, and the concentration can help to balance that. But on the other hand, if you're really good, you know, some people are really good at concentration practice, but they can become quite rigid and sort of caught up in that, you know, just really making sure the mind is concentrated all the time, but they're actually not really being very responsive to what's happening around. So again, that analogy we had in our reading with the water, so that's a bit frozen and, you know, very stable. Ice is very stable compared to water, but it's not very adaptive. It's not really adapting to what's around them. And then also that confidence, you know, the faith, also balancing that with wisdom and mindfulness. So having a sense of faith, but not a blind faith, but bringing that sense of wisdom that we've developed, and mindfulness, really noticing what's going on into it as well. So I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about, you know, a lot of us have probably been thinking a lot about climate change and how we respond to the situation. It's not that it's new, but after the summer we've had, it's certainly very much on the forefront of people's minds. And I was sort of thinking that these are also quite relevant to how we might think about responding to climate change. And the first one is faith or trust. And that's a really tricky one, because, you know, we hear so much about, you know, it's basically all doom and, you know, there's not much that's going to really change things around now, and it's just all really terrible. And there's definitely a truth in that as well. But on the other hand, we can also say, well, I do have some faith that at least my efforts are worthwhile and that it's worth trying to do something about it. And last night, We watched a documentary, 2040, which some of you may have seen, which is basically a documentary made by an Australian man who's got a young child, a four-year-old daughter. And so he didn't want her future to be all doom and gloom. So he actually went around the world and looked at projects that are very hopeful. And what he was looking for were things that were already being done. So not something that might be possible in the future, but were already happening. So it's a really good film to watch if you get an opportunity. And there's fantastic stories in it. But one of them that really struck me was in Bangladesh. So they showed these villages, and every village hut had, really basic huts had a solar panel on the roof. And then inside there was a little meter. And that meter was connected to all the other huts in the village, and that village was connected to the villages around. And basically people had they were able to produce their own power and then to sell and buy as needed. And the fact that a country like Bangladesh can have this happening and functioning, and so people have actually ownership of their power, they own it, they can buy and sell, but it completely bypasses the fossil fuel industry, all those wars that are fought around oil, getting access to oil. And it's just such a simple solution, and it's actually already happening. So yeah, lots of stories like that. And of course, there's lots of stories about regenerative agriculture, which I've talked about before as well. And, all the fantastic examples that are already being done and that are actually very productive. So having that sense of confidence in my efforts and that, I can do something and it's worthwhile. And then the effort required, there's quite a lot of effort required, because in some ways, if you want to live with more environmental consciousness, it doesn't come easily. The way our society is set up at the moment, you almost have to go against the flow a bit. It's not necessarily made easy for you. I mean, there's recycling and stuff, that's all fine. But if you start to go a little bit deeper, there's a lot of things that are sort of working against, just having that happen. So it requires effort. And it requires that sense of, determination and sticking with it. But again, a bit like meditation, the effort is there and it's required. But on the other hand, I actually find it gives me a lot of energy to feel more connected with nature. And so like even something like looking at my garden and, I try to manage the garden organically and have a good ecosystem going so the, insects balance each other. And so of doing that over the years. And I just love being there and noticing and watching and having a sense of what's going on and things. So that actually gives me energy as well. And people often say they feel disconnected from nature. So anything that can help us feel more connected actually is very enriching and is, it gives us a lot of vitality as well. And then mindfulness is really key here as well, because one of the things, if you really think about climate change, is to sit with some really uncomfortable feelings. And mindfulness can help us to do that. It's just to sit with things that are very difficult rather than immediately trying to escape or trying to find solutions or ignore it or something, but just to sort of be present with some really uncomfortable feelings. But also noticing what's going on. Again, a bit like meditation, noticing the subtle things that are happening and the subtle small stories of making a difference as well. And then concentration, I think, is also really important, because my tendency is I want to do everything. I feel like I should be doing 100 things about the environment. And of course, I don't have time and energy for all of those, and it wouldn't be very effective. So for me, I think it's really helpful to think, what can I do well and actually focus on that and have a bit more containment. So the idea with concentration is that we're not wasting our energy everywhere and dispersing it. So it's like going out like through a sieve, but sort of holding it in a container, and then it's much more effective and something we can choose to do. So I think concentration can also be really helpful to really use our energy more wisely rather than just being all really scattered and all over the place. And then wisdom, I think, is a very powerful one too, because I recently wrote for my own website a reflection on the wisdom of not knowing. So the tendency is when something happens like this bushfire season, you look for the scapegoat, you look for the people who've done something wrong and you blame them. And if only they hadn't done it, then everything would be fine. And of course, it's a very normal human tendency, but we know that that's not true, that we're all actually responsible and there's no one solution and no one person to blame. So it's really that sense of we don't actually quite know, you know, we actually don't really know. And in Zen we call that don't know mind, you know, but we don't really know what the solutions are. We might have a sense. We certainly know some things are, you know, probably more worth trying than others, but we don't know how it's going to turn out. We don't know. No one person has all the answers. It's just little bits of information and people doing this and that. So it's sort of helpful to have that sense of wisdom. But there's also the wisdom of the natural world. And that's something that comes through a lot in something like regenerative agriculture. Like once you let the land do what it wants to do, it just knows what to do. Animals come back, the plants know exactly what to do, the ecosystems start happening. And where I run the nature mindfulness retreats, just near Yay, you know, that's high up on a hill, and you look across, you can see all the way to Mount Bull, 150 k's of barren land, basically, it's all been chopped down, you know, felling, when the farmers were paid to improve the land by clear felling. But behind, the state government bought that land back in the 70s to start getting some forest happening again. And there's quite a good bush growing. And then the people running the retreat, they haven't got animals either. So the forest is starting to sort of creep into the land where the retreat place is. And the bracken comes first. It's like the first messenger. And then the acacias come. And then some eucalyptus start to grow and things like that. And of course, the animals start coming back as well. So there's a real natural wisdom that is already there. We have enormous wisdom as well. There's so many ideas that we have as human beings to find solutions. And we can also, of course, learn from indigenous wisdom as well, so and Buddhist wisdom. So there's a lot of forms of wisdom that can help us to develop that, you know, the mindset that can actually help us go forward into the future, rather than having that sense of aversion or just apathy, because I think apathy is quite a natural reaction to what's happening, because it just can seem quite overwhelming. And finally, I feel like all of these, what we can really help us to sort of bring that all into our life is that sense of embodiment and heart. So some of these concepts sound a little bit cerebral, perhaps, a bit head, and I think it's really then coming back into the body and also bringing the heart into our practice and into our relationship with our meditation practice and also the relationship with the natural world.